And now we have all this scientific data that they weren't able to get in the olden days. People are looking for answers and solutions that we're unable to give them. Culture says, hey, it's okay because we're not doing mushrooms in the backfield when we're doing it this way. And because we have so many outcomes that are so positive. Again, I don't love the jazz hand psychedelic solves all because it doesn't. But I am just really, I'm really hopeful for the future for alleviating a lot of the pain that we don't necessarily have to be in, and for expanding people's ability to really return to self.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Kelsey Ramsden. Kelsey is an entrepreneur, author, and speaker, but if you ask her, she'd say she's a creator. At 26, Kelsey was running her own construction company and was ranked the top female entrepreneur of the year by Profit Magazine 2 years in a row. Yet despite the financial success and industry accolades, she never felt so depressed and alone. Kelsey is vulnerable and honest as she shares her struggles with mental health and how a psychedelic therapist helped her find the clarity she needed. Since then, in typical Kelsey fashion, she's gone on to start two new companies on the forefront of psychedelic mental and sexual health. We talk about the misconceptions around psychedelics, the growing body of research for treating depression, anxiety, and opioid addiction, and how getting easy access to legalized therapy is closer than you think. Oh, and I found my new favorite quote, "The monster in the closet is obsolescence." Please enjoy Kelsey Ramsden. Kelsey, welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I think we scheduled it and rescheduled it. And so I'm really excited about this.
I'm super stoked to be here. Yes, thank you for your gracious reschedule. I feel like I'm constantly living this life where I'm like barely tethered to reality and only hardly keeping it together with so many busy things, as we all feel. So I'm so glad we found another time and we're able to make it happen.
Yeah, well, it's fairly early morning, at least the start of our work days here. And one thing that I'd love to get your perspective on. So tell me a little bit more about your morning routine.
Oh my goodness, my morning routine. Okay, so when I'm a good girl, my morning routine starts at 4 and I make it to my gym in my home and I go swim and I come home and I wake my children and I make them hot breakfast and everything is glorious. My bad girl self, when she stays up late, she gets up at 5:30. She scrolls the World Wide Web for an hour and lies in bed and then wakes her children up and makes them a hot breakfast. And so it really kind of depends. It's a heads or tails. It's a game day decision most days, if I'm honest.
It's interesting. I asked that question and I've asked a few guests at the top of the show because I'm like everybody. I'm trying to figure out what weird collection of routines works for me in the morning. It's exercise and, you know, journaling and reading and meditation, et cetera, because I'm trying to refine that and figure it out. But then I asked one of our guests recently about that. She's a big deal, like you, highly accomplished. And I got an answer that I didn't expect. She said, well, Bob, I think you're expecting to hear that I get up at 4 and I'm meditating and journaling and all these things. But honestly, I don't set my alarm. I roll out of bed. Sometimes it's 7, sometimes it's 7:30. I have a coffee. And I figure out what I'm going to do. And it's like, damn, I guess I'm asking that question because I have this assumption that every successful person, whatever that means, is highly disciplined and highly rigorous and has this routine about them. And it turns out, no, some people just get up and figure it out as they go. I'm like, God damn, that didn't even occur to me that I could do that.
Look, I was nominated for class clown and worst procrastinator in my grade 12 class. So I think it's just indicative of, I think, how we're all just very different. We have to figure out our own operating manual. Yeah. Like, I need a goal to perform some kind of activity. If there's no goal, my default is like straight up chilling. That's my base setting.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so there's a few big topics that I'm really excited to cover. It occurred to me, though, that just to set the stage a bit, I guess if we were having this conversation, I don't know, 15 years ago, we'd probably be talking about you as the head of a construction company at 26 and a whole bunch of accolades. And we'd be talking about how you got there and your upbringing and everything. And so I'm just wondering, we don't have to tell that entire story, but I'd love for you to just set the stage and provide some context with that early part of your journey from, you know, going to school and ending up in that place of running those big companies and what you learned about yourself.
Sure. I mean, I think the cheat sheet is I'm like the classic underdog makes good story. I'm the kid who had lots of potential and whose parents were constantly like, will you please apply yourself? And I was more interested in having a lot of fun. You know, I was a captain of sports teams and all those kind of things, but wound up having to negotiate my way into an undergrad. I drove down to the University of Victoria and said, will you let me in on academic probation? And if I don't perform, you can kick me out and you have a full year of tuition. Seems like a good business deal. They let me in. I don't think that would ever happen anymore, but you know, in the old days, we could still do those things. Yeah. And same with my MBA. I applied to every MBA school in Canada and only got into Ivy, the best school. I did not get into like the first skinny little envelope from USASC. And it was because I wrote this essay that compared myself to the universe and drew a picture of the universe. Like every kind of instance in my early days was a coming up of me just throwing Hail Marys and battling back from a corner and, you know, just trying my level best. But ultimately, yeah, I did okay. Got an MBA at Western, graduated, was a consultant for a brief period, woke up one day, looked at my boss, and I was like, yeah, if I had $100 to put on her or me, who would I put it on to define my future? And so I quit that day. And I remember calling the man that I was dating at the time, who ultimately became my husband for a period of time. And I said, I quit my job today. And he was like, what are you going to do? And I said, you're not going to quit your job. That's what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm doing. I just know I can't do this.
I just know what you're going to do.
Yeah, you're not quitting because I have no plan. That's the plan, darling. But I knew how to build roads and that kind of thing because I'd worked in that. So it just seemed like the next right thing to do was try something I had a bit of talent with. And so that's how the construction company got started. Like, I wish I could say there was some grand, beautiful design to my whole career and some great knowing and something to that nature. It really was just a calamity of like fits and spurts and starts and trials and errors and backing myself into corners I had to fight myself out of. So my origin story up into the place of like being Canada's top female entrepreneur and, you know, being this young woman with this big construction company operating well, in lots of places was really not some beautifully designed business plan. It was just, you know, trying to keep my feet under me and using whatever tools I had in my tool belt to stay engaged, to kind of keep my soul alive, to be curious and driven.
So when you say you were working in consulting, you're kind of working for like a big five management consulting kind of firm or construction consulting or?
No, big five making slide decks, telling people what we knew about how they should run their businesses and then leaving the building. And Godspeed to those people. I mean, it's a tough gig to do that work, but it wasn't for me. I thought it was, but I actually like the tangible. What I've come to discover is like the creative process for me includes the creation, not just the notion for it to really land and feel meritous and for me to stay engaged with it. So the consulting thing, although sexy and it looks cool and you travel a lot and all good MBAs should become consultants or financiers, as I'm told, I did my part and then I quit.
What did you learn from that, you know, that brief stint at, you know, at that in the big five world?
I learned that I never really fit in there to begin with. And I kind of got group thought into it. Like when I showed up to MBA school, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a consultant. I was driving a 1993 electric green Honda Civic Del Sol. I was wearing flip-flops, you know, the rainbow flip-flops that you got in Hawaii in the late 80s. I was wearing those. I was just so BC, like glitter festival. And somehow in this like Southwestern Ontario shark tank of black suits, I thought that's what I should do. You know, a good part of my life has actually been not listening to myself very well and listening to what I should do or what people do. And quite frankly, doing a great job of that. But then arriving at those places and being like, wait a minute, how did I get here? Like, what just happened? I don't like this at all. This has nothing to do with what I want to do. but everything to do with what I should do. Consulting was very much that for me. I don't regret it, but did I ever wake up in the morning going, heck yes, I get to interview some staff and build a deck? Not a day. I was like, man, this is crushing my soul.
And that resonates a lot with me too. I had, yeah, I guess, similar in that there was never any question about, oh, so what are you going to do after high school? It was like, well, no, you're going to university. And then there was never any, well, what are you doing after university? Like, you're getting a job. And I was 30 years old. And I just feel like I just took every opportunity that came up. I was, you're going to do this, then you get promoted, then you take this job, then you get this raise. And
wow.
And now I look back on my kids at this age where they're trying to figure out all this. And I'm like, God, please don't fall. I feel this responsibility to give them more freedom and not do the same things I did. Not that it was terrible, but I also wonder, is that just life? Like, maybe you wouldn't have gotten to where you were if you hadn't have gone through that. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we love as humans to think we have a lot more control than we do. And when I really sit and zoom out and look at my life and all the things that have happened, like, I didn't know my best friend 2 minutes before I met her. You know, I didn't know some of these things about my career that I would really love doing until 1 minute before someone else told me about it. So I think a lot about this idea, a bit like Forrest Gump, when he's sitting and this feather kind of comes down and it lands, like that feather had 1,000 places to be before it showed up in that moment. So I'm just always trying to pay attention to the moment to moment opportunities to change the trajectory of life. And I also recognize that some of these absolutely decimating times in our life are required education. You know, if we could avoid them, if we could strategically work our way around them or study out of it or, you know, write a better cover letter. I don't know. I do like to believe that there's a bit of a more grand design than my basic human construct could come up with. Just the other day, I was talking to one of my besties from high school. She came to visit and she was like, Kelsey, if I had told you when we were 15 that this would be your life today, how many pieces would you be like, absolutely? Like, basically, it's zero. Right. Aside from the fact that I'd still have fake dyed blonde hair, every other thing is basically not what I would have said I would be doing. And I'm lucky, you know? This is way better than my original notion of what I thought I might want.
Man, that's so true. And it also, I think about this all the time. You can have a conversation like that with your bestie and look back and look at how terrible we are at predicting how our life is going to unfold, but yet we still are committed to planning out the next 5 or 10 years. Like, no, this is what's going to happen. And we have a whole lifetime of evidence that tells us you have no idea what's going to happen. And you can spend your life planning for things, and that's not one of those pieces, except for your blonde hair, is going to go to plan. So does that mean we never plan for anything? I don't know. But it's really interesting.
No, I have an idea on this. So when I was a kid, my parents made me learn how to golf, and I hated them for it because Tiger Woods hadn't happened yet. It was not cool to be a golfer and take your clubs on the bus on Wednesdays for junior golf. But one of my greatest life lessons happened when I was probably, you know, 12 or 13 years old at junior golf. And the fellow who was instructing us said, okay, so you tee up your ball and there's the hole way down there, 300 yards away, 400 yards away. And if at the inception point of your strike, you're off by 1 degree, by the time it gets to the hole, you're maybe 20 yards off of a hole in one. But if you make shorter, more concise strokes, even if you're off by 5 degrees, but you only go 10 feet, you have a higher likelihood of getting to your goal. Plus, you're also, you know, 10 feet closer, so you can actually see the hole a little bit better and define your target. And I feel like my life has been a lot like that. A lot of things happened in pretty short order. So I've got to do these kind of micro adaptations as I've like continually fucked up a little. But to your point, we set this 5-year goal, this like the 500 yard, and we try and drive for a hole in one, which is asinine. But this is our notion. So I kind of like reconstitute and go, okay, cool. This is a 500 yard deal. I'd like to be near the hole, But I recognize that I got to check in way more often than I think we're told. Who am I now? Do I even want this same goal? Like, is it okay to change? Right. I don't know if that's the way, but it's a way that helps me. I try and teach my kids that, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. We're all just trying.
Well, that's awesome. So yeah, I wonder, so coming back to your journey as the head of these land development companies that you started, like what was it that made you realize that, okay, I've done these things. Maybe this isn't what I want to do anymore. And I want to change course and pick up a different club and try something new.
Yeah. Some of it was self-derived. Some of it was like I love building roads and I like the people that I got to work with. And I like traveling around and being in the north of Canada and pioneering things. Like that was all a lot of fun. And then I had our first child and I realized that wasn't really like a super conducive way of living with this like little baby on my hip in getting on some like one propeller plane in the Northwest Territories going, this is unsafe. This is not wise. So some of it, like life happened for me and I had to adapt as a result of that. But I would say that I think the times where I've made the choice has only ever been from turmoil. Like that consulting gig, quitting it was just like, I can't stomach this another day. Stopping doing the land development and construction companies was really just like, I'd won all these awards. I was meant to be super happy. I did all the things I thought I was meant to do. I was on the cover of all these magazines and I was at the very same time, like suicidally depressed and just like, did not want to live that life anymore because I created the life I thought I was supposed to create, not the one that I actually wanted. In a way, parts of it I wanted kids and financial freedom and that kind of thing, but I didn't want to do it that way. So I couldn't help but stop doing it. There didn't seem to be another way out of that. So, you know, like I say, it would be nice to say, oh, I just academically decided about a change. It was not academic. It was visceral and physical and spiritual and emotional. And then I just didn't really have a choice but to choose something else. And those something else choices weren't often very strategic either. They were kind of just like listening and taking this small next right step because changing career or changing definition of self or doing all of these things for me has felt overwhelming. I have notoriously high expectations of myself and so admitting defeat or adaptation or all these things is like pretty difficult waters to sail when society would say, hey, girl, you're doing great. Why not just keep it up? Like, what's your problem? You should be happy.
And what did that look like? So is this around the time when you wrote the book, The Success Hangover? Is that, and then you started speaking a little bit more about your experiences?
Yeah, Success Hangover was just like my own journal entry about that like crippling idea that nobody wants to talk about because it's unbecoming to be like, here I am. I did all the things I said I was going to do and I'm still not happy. Nobody really wants to hear a lot about that. But there's a lot of us out there who are like, I got the degree, I built the family, I built the business. And now, you know, I aged, I became more wise, my goals and plans changed. So yeah, so I wrote Success Hangover and I published it. And then I surprisingly started being asked to travel around a lot and speak about it. And again, not by my grand design, just like the feather in Forrest Gump shows up and lands on my knee and says, hey, do you want to do a European speaking tour? Like, well, that sounds cool. Sure. And that was also, it just gave me a reason a bit to get out of bed for a while when I didn't know what else to do. And I met a lot of great people. And that's how I actually met my psychedelic therapist ultimately that led to the next business, you know, like just random collisions of life out there.
Yeah, that's amazing. I wonder if there's people out there being like, do you know how long I've been trying to launch a European speaking career? And Kelsey just like stumbled ass backwards into it. I'm not sure how inspired I'm supposed to feel about that.
You know what? I think I've done it both ways. You know, I've tried really hard at something and failed, had a really concrete goal, worked my face off and just got kicked in the teeth. And I've had these random happenstances where it wasn't by my design or my great effort. It was just I was in the right place at the right time with the right message with the right people. And, you know, and that's where I think our ego gets so over-involved. Like this notion that as if we were God ourself, we could make something happen is, again, to use this, like, is so asinine. But oftentimes, you know, I've stayed too long in relationship with career, in relationship with people, in relationship with parts of myself where I know it's not working. But I said I wanted it, or I told people it was the plan, or, you know, whatever. And my ego just got so involved. Mm-hmm. You know, people can hear that word a lot of different ways, but that's just like, that's a suit that I built to protect myself. It's like Valentino. It is so custom fit. It's insane how perfectly it protects all the self parts of me that had to create or become a thing in my growing up. That to retailer, it seems like, oh, damn, I paid a lot of money for that. I put 47 years into that baby, you know? But it doesn't fit the way I want it to.
Yeah, interesting. So setting the ego aside, well, you know, helps to not only maybe find new opportunities that you were kind of blind to before, but also allows you to just say yes to scary shit.
Amen.
You know, that comfy Valentino suit would never let you try or say because it just doesn't fit.
Totally. I love that part of it is the saying yes to scary shit. Look, we did so much of that when we were kids. It's just so bizarre to me. Like, nobody rode a bike the first time they got on it. Zero of us did that. But we were like, that looks amazing. I can't wait to wipe out and skin my knee and then be, you know, part of the club that rides bikes. And then somehow as adults, we never expect to skin our knees and wipe out and have to come home crying and have someone care for us. We just expect to ace it and land every single thing that we do. I like to use this visual representation for myself when I'm thinking about it. You know, double Dutch skipping?
Oh, yeah.
It's like two ropes, yeah, and there's two people on either side and they're doing the circles. And then there's a person standing there like leaning in, leaning out, getting the time for the jump. And they do that for a really, really super long time. And from far away, you could observe that and say, is that person double Dutch skipping? And one person may say, yes, they are, because they're leaning in and leaning out and they seem to be engaged in the process. And another person might say, absolutely not. And that to me is that part around like, if you jump in, you're skipping. Otherwise, you're just you're having the notion of skipping. Mm. And I've done a lot of that, to be honest, both, you know, I've jumped, I've failed, I've jumped, I've made it. I've been the notional skipper.
Yeah.
And grace to all of it, you had to do all those parts to get to the ultimate success. You had to lean in, lean out. You had to jump in and screw it up. And then one fine time, you start jumping. And then once you're jumping, you're like, shit, how do I get out of here?
I love that analogy. I want to come back to your psychedelic therapist because I think that takes us into the next kind of era of your life and career. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, if you're from Canada, you've heard the phrase, the TSN turning point. It's a program in Canada that broadcasts sports mm-hmm. and there's a moment in the game where everything changes. And I remember that moment because I wasn't doing super well. And I had seen years and years of therapists and I'd been on antidepressants, I put some good solid reps in and I wasn't really getting too far too fast. And a friend of mine from undergrad who was working with a company out west who was doing some work with Johns Hopkins University on depression trials with psilocybin or magic mushrooms as we would have known them at university or high school, depending on your nature. She started sending me some research and really good outcomes that were coming from people who were in a disciplined setting being provided with magic mushrooms, and they were, you know, having tremendous outcomes with their depression. So I'm reading all this research and I'm thinking, Kelsey, you're like in your late 30s, you have three children, you run these businesses. What are you thinking going back and doing drugs? That is not the solution. Like, it was a good escape before, but it actually kind of is part of the problem sometimes too. And ultimately, by virtue of all this research, I had enough interest. I started listening to this podcast with this guy. Tim Ferriss is a podcaster that some folks know. And he had this fellow on, his name is Dr. Dan Engel, and he was talking about psychedelics. And so it was kind of these worlds colliding, you know, when you get the multiplicity of information from a lot of data, and you go, oh, this is a sign. And then I was on the speaking tour, and doesn't Dr. Dan Engel show up on the speaking docket? Okay, though this is a sign. I mean, honestly, I could have just gone straight to it right from the beginning, but I had to wait for enough things to add up to make it feel like I had my permission slip. So I engaged in a course of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. He's a board certified psychiatrist and neurologist who's also been in shamanistic training for a long time. We went to a place where it was legally available. And I always hesitate at this moment because I never liked the kind of jazz hand psychedelia, like it solves all your problems, because it doesn't. You solve all your problems after you've had the experience. But the experience itself gave me such a deep and rich and clear, precise, deep knowing and understanding of what needed to be done with all of the grace and ease of the egoless experience of not making anyone wrong in it and allowing me to go out the other side totally clear. So that was my first psychedelic experience, and I just kind of never looked back. Then I thought, oftentimes, how can I bring this to other people in a way that it's accepted, because a lot of people hear psychedelics and they think, yeah, I dropped acid in high school, or, you know, they heard this story about the guy who went crazy or whatever the case may be. And this is something really entirely different. So I made it my new life's work to be the now 47-year-old mother of three, who's somewhat respectable, out there talking about how psychedelic medicine can heal people and expand our awareness. You don't actually necessarily have to be harmed to have an opportunity to grow.
I was thinking about that. Is that frustrating that I imagine you must have to spend most of your time describing how this is not what people's, you know, the last time they took mushrooms was in high school or university or took acid and everybody had a bad trip or knows somebody that had a bad trip. And you're just like, this is a highly scientific field, and I get kind of tired of having to explain why this is legitimate. Is that a big part of your life?
So I started a psychedelic drug research company and took it public. And that was about 4 years ago. And at that time, yes, ad nauseum, I was like, no, I'm not selling drugs out of the back of my car. Now it's in Time Magazine. It's been seen on CNN a multiple city of times. It's like in the New Yorker, people are talking a lot about it. There's been a tremendous amount of funding in this space. And the number of messages I get now from someone's auntie who has someone who's been suffering with anxiety, or someone who's, so the women at the grassroots level have really, in the old way of, like, you know, the old wives' solutions of putting mustard compresses on things or whatever. So the psychedelic kind of world at the very grassroots has advanced greatly as a result of one person doing it and telling their mother or sister, and that mother or sister sharing it with someone else, and that woman sharing it with someone else, in a way that then when they do see the CNN thing, they go, oh, this is real. So I spend less time doing that now and more time doing the actual work.
Hmm. So maybe this is a stupid question, but is this legal?
It depends. So because it's moving pretty quick. So yes, if we want to go to the Netherlands, we can do work there. We can do work in Jamaica. We can do work in places in South America. And there's a plenty of psychedelic medicines. Mostly we talk about mushrooms, but obviously there's LSD. There's something called ayahuasca. There's something called ibogaine. Of the mushroom varietals themselves, there's over 200 psychedelic varietals. So when you got your bag of mushrooms and went to your outdoor music festival, it could have been one of 200 different types. You didn't know that. So yes, it's legal in different places. But if people are really interested, I would say what's coming next is MDMA will be legal in America within 12 months' time. And MDMA is typically used for treating PTSD, but close on the heels of that will be a lot of couples therapy work as well, because transformative for relational affairs. So it's coming. It's coming fast. I'm so glad I was out there being weird 5 years ago, and now it's kind of getting normal.
No kidding. So it's obviously had a big impact on you. What are some of the other stories that you've heard or people that you've, you know, the difference that it's made on people?
Yeah, I think most of the more predominant stories are of war vets. There are some great documented stories of Navy SEALs coming back, high rates of suicidality, of course, in that population, and people who are suffering from extreme PTSD and who have done for 10 or 15 years can no longer leave their homes. They do a course of 3 therapeutic psychedelic sessions and 6 talk therapy sessions, and they no longer register on the PTSD scale. There's research going on for major depressive disorder. That is depression that has been treated by everything else known to God and man that is not responding. People who are living with constant suicidal ideation for years. And after 3 treatments using psychedelic mushrooms, they no longer register on the depression scale in any way. So there are some really tremendous research programs who are advancing this kind of medicine. And if anyone's curious on just like a little bit of, you know, armchair interest, there's a documentary on Netflix. It was done by a man named Michael Pollan. It's called How to Change Your Mind. He wrote a book of that same title that became a New York Times bestseller, talking about the use of psychedelic medications, both historically, culturally, and then now medically. Opiate addiction is another amazing one. Ibogaine, if you can believe it, 1 course of Ibogaine, which means you're under the psychedelic influence for 18 to 24 hours. So for a lot of people, that's a long trip, but no withdrawal symptoms and no yearnings for the opiate for up to 6 months. It's like magic. I'm really excited about what these medicines can do when they're properly deployed.
Well, I remember watching that Netflix documentary, super interesting. So one of the things that I remember taking away from that is all of this promising research that was happening with LSD and psilocybin back in the 60s, and then it just stopped, right? It got added to the schedule of banned substances, and the research stopped for 30 years. Is that a risk, or have we reached a tipping point where you think, I think we're good, or do you worry about that happening again?
Good question. I think we're good, and here's why. The modern psychedelic renaissance was really kicked off by Silicon Valley. And as much as many of we psychonauts maybe don't totally align with the values and virtues of Silicon Valley, it was really the likes of Steve Jobs and some of those fellows down there who started microdosing LSD and macrodosing psychedelics to get clarity and focus and deeper connection to self. And take their ego off to make better choices and to heal relationships in their companies and with their partners and communities. So when the tech bros started doing it, that kind of made it culturally okay, because we like that their stock prices all went up. And in our kind of modern culture, when people who have a reverent position and who control some kind of financial device and who control a cultural device like our cell phones, when they're doing these things and it's working for them, we go, it seems all right. And now we have all this scientific data that they weren't able to get in the olden days en masse in the way that we have now. So I think when we mix culture and science and the tremendous amount of pain that people are in, like we're really at this kind of tipping point moment where people are looking for answers and solutions that we're unable to give them. Culture says, hey, it's okay because we're not doing mushrooms in the backfield when we're doing it this way. And because we have so many outcomes that are so positive, and people utilizing these medicines in a way that isn't just only about healing, but also about expansion, I don't think there's any coming back. Like, I think we're over the falls on this one. And I get so excited. I just can't even, I don't know. Again, I don't love the jazz hand psychedelic solves all, because it doesn't, but I am just really, I'm really hopeful for the future, for alleviating a lot of the pain that we don't necessarily have to be in, and for expanding people's ability to really return to self.
So how long do you think people can go to their family doctor and get referred to a psychedelic therapist as easily as they can, you know, talking to a counselor, or maybe not even, they don't even need a referral from a doctor.
Well, right now in Australia, they can already do that. And I think 12 months in America, I think Canada will be very close behind. I think we're probably 14, 15 months away. There's a special access program in Canada where if you have one of those indications and you go to your doctor and you've tried some other things, you can get a special medical provision called the Section 56 exemption. So it's available. You know, I'm thinking a year to a year and a half, and you're going to hear a lot of people doing this kind of work. And otherwise, there's a big gray market where lots and lots of people are doing it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Super interesting. And like I said, I mean, I don't right now, I don't suffer from some of those, you know, very serious sort of mental issues that a lot of people face. But I just get this sense as I, you know, and maybe it's just being in the, you know, the autumn of my life, as a lot of us get to this point and think like, you know, what am I doing here? Like, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? And I don't want to get overly philosophical about it, but I do feel like there's something right there that I just can't put my fingers on it. And maybe I need some help sort of bursting through that. And then, but then sometimes I'm like, well, you know, you've been sober for 2 years, so maybe this is just an excuse to get fucked up again. So maybe, so I'm sort of like, well, that's a possibility too.
I mean, I can tell you about someone I was recently in session with, who was about our age, who, you know, nothing's necessarily wrong. Everything is just kind of like in this very highly sufficient to marginally optimal in many areas. And at about the 1 hour mark, she popped up and she was like, write this down. I'm calling my sister. I'm telling her this. I'm doing this with my children. I'm going to climb this mountain. I'm doing that. I'm doing this. This happens. I'm selling that car I never really wanted. I'm getting the grape. Like, it was like a laundry list of decisive, here's what I'm doing next. And here's the big dream. And that was it. There was nothing to heal. There was nothing to solve. There was nothing to, it was just kind of to your point, this place in our life that's a bit like, there's a lot of tabs that are open. Can we close some tabs? You know, like search a few new things and make a couple plans that get us a little bit closer to determining, yeah, do I want to retire in Spain? I don't know. Maybe I should go there. Maybe I should book that trip. So I'm all for it. Strong advocate for just the expansive and clear nature of what these things can do. I don't think you have to be sick to be unwell.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I love that. So for people that are interested in whether they're on the continuum of just sort of curious or they're, you know, like where can they go for trusted information? Because trusted information is not always easy to find.
Amen to that. This is a tricky question. I often tell people start with the Michael Pollan stuff. The next thing is if you're really looking for a therapist, start to determine what kind of experience you want to have. Like I say, these different experiences are really quite different. Ayahuasca is very different than psilocybin, very different than MDMA. And the Google can tell you a bit about that, but really briefly, ayahuasca is something you drink. Typically, you drink it in the jungle. That's the one you hear about people who might be vomiting and pooping their pants. It's intense. It can be really restorative. Some people love it. I'm not a fan. Ketamine is legal. You could take it orally or intravenously. There's clinics in North America. It's a dissociative. So you kind of just float out for a little while. Works quite well for depressive episodes, but not really good for expansion. Mushrooms, as we know, are pretty psychedelic. You know, if you want to get some clarity and maybe if you're lucky, go and touch the oneness and get a sense of why we're all here. It's kind of more down that road. And MDMA is just really restorative for clarity and connection and understanding of self and other. So if you're dealing with kind of relational, like what do I really want? How do I relate to someone else? MDMA would be your best bet. So those are kind of the top four that people talk about most often. And if you wanted to take the next step from there and we're looking for a place, I would say there's just four most important primary things when you think about psychedelic practice in this way. Set, that's your mindset. Why are you doing it? Are you really up for it? Setting, where are you having it done? What does that place and space look like and feel like? sacrament, that's the medicine. So making sure that it's cleanly sourced and really well understood and that kind of thing. And then the final piece is the facilitation. So knowing that that person knows what they're doing, I like to tell people to ask the question, is there anywhere that I go that you can't be with me? Meaning, like, if I stumble across some childhood stuff, or if I wind up talking to God, are you going to be able to be with me when I lift up my mask and have to orient to another person in the world about that? And if the facilitator has any hesitation, pick another one, because you can go a lot of places, you know, it's a really important thing to ask.
So much to think about. That's awesome. It's just it's a very new world to me, right? And the idea of this podcast is always, hey, let's go out and talk to people about things, you know, nothing about and way outside your comfort zone. It's like, well, this is where I am. I mean, this is so good. I love this. So now here you sit, you're CEO of your fourth company. You know, what's next? Like I mentioned the autumn of my life. Like, what are you most excited about now?
I'm doing the launching my children thing. So every day I say, do they want me more and need me less? If I'm doing that, I think I'm doing okay. So that's primary. Secondary is I think about my funeral every day. I make sure that every day I'm doing something that could be remarked on, you know? I just imagine this like awesome timeline of a whole calamity of these moments of feathers landing on laps where they go, oh my God, and then she did this. Oh, and then that piece, you know? So I think about that. So I'm working on making my timeline still remain interesting. And really what's important to me right at the moment is intimacy, psychedelics, partnerships. So I spend a lot of time doing that kind of work, piecing together what will be the next business, which is focused around couples connecting and facilitated through MDMA experiences.
Yeah, interesting. And as you look back on all of these businesses you've built, what have you learned about yourself? Like, what's the common thread that ties these things together? I think you talked earlier about, you know, what are you really good at? Like, what is the Kelsey secret sauce that's allowed you to do this over and over again?
It's funny. I think I mentioned the other day when you and I were talking, like, it's difficult to see the label when you're inside of the jar. And for so many years, I was like, what is my thing, man? What is it about me? And I thought it was getting degrees, or I thought it was knowing people, or I thought, you know, all these things that you kind of think it is. But ultimately, when I look at it, I'm a creator that deeply values intimate connection. And no matter what my business is, if I'm building roads or neighborhoods or writing books or psychedelic drug research or, you know, creating intimate experiences for people, if I'm creating and I'm intimately connected and the people I work with are like amazing, I'm super happy to get up every single day.
You just described a pretty idyllic kind of company and situation. I mean, what's the best advice you've got for people that are trying to build that sense of cohesion and trust and sense of purpose in their companies?
I think one thing I do at interviews has landed me some people that I had no right poaching from other companies. It was being really honest about my own shortcomings. So I'll always say, like, it's going to be a lot of fun to work with me when I'm in a great mood and we're doing super well. But when my tone changes and I sound like this, my cadence moves to this, and we get really focused, it's going to feel different. And you being equally as excited to deal with this part of me collegiately, because we're always shoulder to shoulder. I can't do any of this without everyone else. Then we know we have something, you know, like really being honest and telling them, like, look, if you send me an email that's longer than three paragraphs, it gets unanswered. That's just true. So don't think it's not because you're smart and I don't want to read it. It's because that's my own weakness. So one is like being really candid about who you are as a leader and how it's going to be, not only when it's like Google times and we're all playing pinball as rad, but when it's like, it's 4 a.m. and I've just vomited in the bucket beside my desk because I'm scared about us not getting the financing. Like, do you want to be on the field with me then? And then I think the other thing is like, just care for people, pay attention, listen. That part of building teams is really actually easy when you slow down a little bit take the 3 minutes to, and not water cooler care, not like, so how's the weather in DC today? You know,
right.
Like, how was your son's game? What matters to that person? And then I would say the final thing about building teams is like, throw the Hail Mary to the person you really want on your team. Like, give them the agency to say no to you. Don't say no to yourself before you even ask to them. I do it all the time. You will be shocked at who will come and work with you if you have a compelling vision. And if you really want to commit yourself to it, you will be astounded with who will come and work with you if you just give them the opportunity to say yes.
Wow. Yeah. I love that. So just wrapping things up here, Kelsey, man, this conversation is going to sit with me for a while. Is there a question that I haven't asked that you were really hoping to provide a really good, thoughtful answer to?
A question that you haven't asked. I get curious about what could take you out. Like, what's the thing that's just on the precipice of being seen? You know, I get a little bit curious about that evolution of self in my own leadership when I start to just kind of whiff a weakness. And for me right now, at this part of my career, I'm whiffing this weakness of becoming obsolete. I'm just getting this little taste where I hear the kids talking about things and I go, wait a minute now, is this the part where I, like when my parents would have me come home and program the 12 to stop flashing on the VHS and I'd be like, oh my God, come on you guys. Am I there? I'm just getting a taste of that. And I don't know the solution for sure, but I feel like there's something there for me to pay attention to. I feel like making friends that are younger feels important. I feel like the idea of changing what I think about mentorship as opposed to being over me as being under me in terms of age, but not experience, because those people are living a very different life in a very different time. It's just, I don't have a window in the same way. So I get a little bit curious about that question around, like, what are you just catching a whiff of that feels like there might be something that could be your greatest demise? The monster in the closet, I think, is obsolescence.
I think mentoring for me is very much a two-way thing. Like, if I'm not learning as much as they are, that's how you become irrelevant and obsolete, as you said, quickly. So I think I spend a lot of time thinking about that.
Yeah. Let's just stay relevant. I mean, that sounds good.
How hard can it be?
We'll live forever. We'll be totally woke. We'll talk to you. I mean, done. Okay, problem solved. Anything else?
Well, this has been amazing, Kelsey. Thank you so much for this. What I love about this job and these conversations I have is I always look back on them and go, oh, shit. Well, how could I not? How could I have left that carrot dangling? Or how could I not have talked to her about this? But that just means we get to continue the conversation someday over
Absolutely.
At the beach or in another episode. So I look forward to it.
100%. Thank you for having me. It's good. It's been a good gem. I always appreciate exploring the little edges of things. So thanks for taking me there.
The Growth Mixtape podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.